Hello everyone and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast, brought to you by Shoshinworks in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. I'm your host, Marco Annunziata, was born as an economist and he worked in policy, finance, industry, and done a lot of work in innovation and on innovation, which brought me also to intersect with our guest today. But before we get started, a reminder, as our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, the economy, and policy, and they are reframing how we innovate and build for resilient futures. In this series brought to you by Shoshinworks in collaboration with NASA Convergence Aeronautics Solutions Project, we are exploring these new ecosystemic models and impacts. And over the next three episodes, we will be diving deep into human complexity, how taming it and leveraging it can help solve problems, and finally, how to grow an ecosystemic future surmounting multi-scale challenges. My co-host today is James Villarubia from NASA. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Marco. Hello, everyone. My name is James Villarubia. I'm currently a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, where I help the engineers and the scientists there use AI to imagine and design better futures for humanity. So there's a lot of crossover in that space with today's topic and today's guest. So I'm really excited to have this conversation. Back to you, Marco.
Thanks, James. And I could not possibly be more excited to introduce today's guest, who is my longtime friend, Mickey McManus. Mickey is a senior advisor and leadership coach at the Boston Consulting Group currently, but he's also run Maya, a consulting design firm. Mickey has done a fantastic amount of work at the intersection of humans and machines. And I'll let Mickey give more of an introduction of himself. Mickey, welcome. Thanks for being with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marco. It's always good to see you. I remember fondly the times we sat right next to each other and you kept challenging everything I was thinking and doing and poking me on sort of, okay, but what about the macroeconomic angle? What about this whole approach, you know, to how value is shared and played with and everything? And James, always good to see you. So my name is Mickey McManus. And as Marco said, I'm a senior advisor and actually an executive leadership coach at Boston Consulting Group at BCG. And about 6 years ago, I sold them a company that was really an interdisciplinary, human-centered design strategic consultancy that came out of Carnegie Mellon more than 30 years ago now, called Maya. And I think if you were to look deeply, I'm a designer. I'm going to die a designer. I was born to be, early on, I said to my parents, I really want to be a mad scientist, but then there weren't any degrees in mad science. So the closest I could find was this amazing School of Art and Architecture where they were designing typefaces and font and buildings and motorcycles and monorails. And I was like, what is this? And it was the field of design. It was industrial design or product design. And I think now I've probably evolved into what Buckminster Fuller would have called the design scientist. And I really feel like the rigor of science and the rigor of the scientific method combined with really understanding humans and the weird wonders and complexities of humans and sort of being able to subvert our own ego and take on someone who's a need knower or a community of people who have pain and need and being able to, instead of pursue my own agenda, sort of as an artist and, you know, try to exercise my demons, I have to get rid of that and I have to take on someone else's agenda, but bring my creativity, bring my passion and bring those things to help, I guess I would say, tame complexity and help people find the power that complexity brings without the sort of messiness of it.
And Mickey, tell us a little bit more about your work, because indeed you are a designer and you've been focusing on complexity, focusing on human complexity, but you've also focused a lot on what happens when machines come to the table, bringing additional potential, additional complexity. You've written a fascinating book, Trillions, debating exactly what happens when trillions of machines and devices and gadgets get online and crowd the field together with us. So give us a bit more context about your work on the teaming up of humans and machines and the implications for lifelong learning.
Yeah, well, a big question. So you mentioned trillions, and part of the core research we did at Maya, we were not only a consultancy that worked for public companies and, you know, going concerns like that, but we also about 30% of our work was research into information systems and into what happens when the world goes from sort of dumb, dead products to connected and, you know, sensing and in some ways living product at the edges. And that led to, we invested in our own research and we spun out multiple companies along the lines, all focused on taming complexity. And I can get into that more. And all based on this idea of a connected world and that we were moving from a largely disconnected world. You know, your toaster was just a toaster. Your speaker was mostly connected to the amplifier or your, you know, CD player or your record player or something like that. And suddenly everything had a chip in it and could hide almost infinite complexity inside of it. And I think the first indicator of that was, I remember a Time magazine cover story, and it had a picture, if anyone remembers what VCRs are, it had a picture of a VCR with a flashing 12, because it turns out people all got these things called VCRs, video cassette recorders, and then they had them at home. It was our first ability to time shift TV. We could like record that cool episode of Seinfeld, and then we could go back and we could watch it. And there was nobody on the planet who could figure out how to program that damn timer thing. And it was because they suddenly put a chip in there. And, you know, they were trying to be smart. So they were like, well, you know, we could have like a 12-day or 14-day timer, and it could be set up so that it could turn on, record your favorite episode, turn off. But they all wanted you to program with like two buttons. So it was almost like they took this thing that could have just been, a twist knot dial for like a clock or something, and they put a chip in it, which was much cheaper, by the way, to put a little chip in it that you could write some code, because instead of making those mechanical devices like a knob with a rheostat and, you know, other things, you could just have a chip and maybe two buttons. And they were like, well, hide it all in there. And what they were doing was hiding an infinite amount of complexity in a simple consumer product. And this was before they were connected. It was just putting a chip in it. And if you think of it, and this was really the thesis of Trillions, people are going to put trillions of computational devices in everything we have. And people kind of laughed at us when we said there would be trillions of computational devices when we published the book in 2012, 2013. But now everyone's like, yeah, it's happening. I mean, there are probably about 100 chips in your car. There are definitely, you know, I would say 50 chips around your house at least. And you multiply that times, you know, billions of people, and it turns out we have a lot of complexity. And if you're like a manufacturer of Maytag washing machines or, you know, Jennair ovens, and you say, oh, a washing machine, it's got this electromechanical dial, and it's got to turn on the gas, and it's got to turn on the heat, and it's got to turn on the water, and then it's got to turn it off, and then it's got to like turn on the agitator of the motor. It's the most complex, expensive part of a washing machine, and it hasn't changed in like 100 years. If I could replace that with a chip that doesn't have all the electromechanical stuff, and I've got, and Maytag and the company that owns it, Whirlpool, they make about 40 million of these a year, and each one has to have this complex electromechanical thing. If I can put a chip in it and then just say, wash the clothes like my partner washes them, because they always get them cleaner, or wash it like I did last week, just remember things and maybe turn on and off the washing dryer, and maybe even have a deal with Tide and say, now that we know the formulation of your soap, we could like have a machine-to-machine relationship between like reading the barcode on the soap and like washing your clothes better. Like, people will do this. And in our book, we talked about how probably the machine-to-machine economy, you know, and at the time we called it something like, you know, the trillions economy, but it was just machine and machines, would overwhelm how many people were buying from people. And we had to kind of understand how to tame that complexity and how to give people the power of that complexity without the malignancy. And in some ways, the book is really about, if you've never done anything that complex, no humans have ever made a trillion of anything that were smart or sophisticated, but your body has 50 trillion little cells, and you, life is just this glorious, beautiful complexity. So rather than what I would portray, a lot of what's happened today is unbounded malignant complexity, what would happen if we had beautiful complexity? And so if you've never done anything really complex, you should always go find someone who's already done something like that. And nature is our guide. And a big part of our book is about sort of what we can learn from nature in terms of taming complexity.
I love that example of sort of the VCR flashing 12 and the struggle, because I mean, I know my parents certainly had that trouble and I still get phone calls occasionally, though I think I've solved it finally. The tech got better and faster than they were. But it, I guess
I love the kids that are always like the IT tech services or something.
Yep, exactly. So, I mean, I definitely sort of lived that transition, I think, as a millennial, sort of growing up in sort of the not digital space. And then sort of, you know, my formative years were really learning these technologies as they came out. I guess what I thought was sort of interesting about your story there was that the transition was, you know, you sort of mentioned from product, but I'm interested as from a designer perspective, how did the ecosystem of design or the sort of the philosophy around systems thinking change to sort of fit that narrative? Was it a lagging process, a leading process? I mean, what did you see from your peers in the space as these things changed over time?
Well, this was a weird thing. You know, so I remember growing up and designing scales and toothbrushes and, you know, things you'd find at Sears or, you know, things later you'd find at Best Buy or whatever. And everything was about form and, you know, sculpture. And a lot of my peers, when I was going to college, they took product design courses, but they didn't take communication design courses. And they certainly didn't take math courses or programming like Fortran or assembly language. And I took all of those because I was trying to understand, you know, the surface matters. Like today that you call it a user experience, that a UX matters. But sometimes that's rendered as a knob, a physical thing and a beautiful sculpture. And it's sort of a piece of delight. You know, you get it, you just, oh, I love this and I want to touch it. You know, and sometimes that user experience comes out as a dial on a screen or a touch thing. And I think there were some people that were really exploring this in the space of human-computer interaction, which has become a field. But really, classic product designers were lagging. They were trying to take all of the ways that they thought about things for the last 70 years, since the 1930s, when Raymond Loewy and Norman Bel Geddes and others kind of created the product design, the industrial design field, to help us invent our way out of the Great Depression and bring design qualities. Those didn't really change. And so I would find, when I would even hire designers, they really were focused on the form and the materiality. And I think the form and material is super important. But then what happens is design gets kind of dismissed as the last minute makeup that you put on before you rush out to the ball. And it becomes this kind of belief that it's kind of just cute and fluffy. And design is really this weird, if we do design well, particularly human-centered design, where we actually care about the human, we are, in some ways, that representative that has to stand between the plumbing, the machine, the thing, the way the circuit is built, the way the plastic is molded, all that stuff. We have to stand between that thing and the human need. And we have to be the sort of interface or transducer between those two. And I think that's what I started seeing, was that the joy of this is that if you could actually understand how humans think, and you could understand the mental model, not the psychographics of I'm a single person and I'm 22 and I just, you know, got out of college, or I have this much on my credit card, the psychographics or the economic stuff. But if you could understand the mental model, like how does somebody who has diabetes, how do they actually understand what's going on when they test themselves with a little diabetes test monitor? Because there are certain people who like have no idea. They think it's magic. Like they do this and then they know they should eat like a chocolate bar because they're feeling weird. And then there are other people who have a mental model that like they're super in control. They're like type A CEO people. And they think they know more than they know about how to manage their diabetes. And they end up kind of going off a cliff a different way. But if you can understand their mental models, then you could kind of shape an experience for those people that need it the most. And you could also realize that there were certain categories of people who they just love tinkering. They love figuring it out. And you don't have to really give them many many bridges. They'll figure it out. But by doing that, you really are putting yourself as this, you're trying to be a representative when they're not in the room. And that really led me to fall in love with the idea of having an interdisciplinary team. So we had at Maya, it was founded by a cognitive psychologist who studied how people think and how they form mental models. Dr. Peter Lucas, who studied under J.J. Gibson, who was one of the sort of creators of cognitive psychology around perception and how the eyes have a feedback loop between the eye and the brain and understand these invariants in nature. But also we had engineers who understood how to build things, electrical and mechanical engineers, and sort of how to make the thing in the world. And then we had designers and architects and game designers, product designers, who really understood this form function, but also how to be that, how to stand in that kind of threshold between people and the design and the production of something and the plumbing behind the scenes.
Yeah. You brought up this, I think people have this idea that a lot of problems in design have been solved and sort of challenged that notion. I was like, well, I think we keep coming back to them. You talked about the knob and it made me think of sort of growing up as this big push for don't be on your cell phone, don't be texting on your cell phone, no text and drive. And at the same time, all these cars are pushing out touchscreens. Yeah. And the cognitive load of trying to operate something with no tactical feedback without using your eyes is really hard. And now we're going back to knobs because people complain so much. I mean, I think there's really a lot of room still in this space, and that's great.
Well, and I do worry about this. I have a few projects that I worked on for major automotive manufacturers around interfaces. And it led to a few patents early on about connected spaces. And one of the things was like a speed-dependent interface. So like if you're parked, show this, that's fine. If you're going 30 miles an hour, the brain is not going to be able to process this stuff. So please clear it all away. And it was kind of a speed-dependent, you know, interface so that it could take context into account and human cognition. I think, Marco, you said about even human learning. I think we learn so much about how the brain works. And humans are kind of amazing. And we have all these beautiful shortcuts that keep us alive. We think of them as biases sometimes. But the bias is just sort of like a pair of corduroy. You got like kind of it's slippery in one direction and it's kind of hard to slide your hand in the other direction. It's just it's a shortcut that we evolved over a really long period of time. Sometimes those we can capitalize on and really help people do powerful things. But sometimes they can be co-opted, right? We've seen a lot of social media companies and others who gamify things. But what they're really doing is they're playing to these biases that were great when we were like hunting for mammoths. And if we could ever find sugar or if we could ever find, you know, protein, eat it. But if we go to Las Vegas, variable reward, I found protein, eat it all, variable time. If I ever find it, do it. Turns into like, I pull that lever until I lose all my money, you know? And people have turned that into kind of gamified interfaces, which unfortunately kind of trap us with our biases.
And Mickey, this is really, it's tremendously useful for us to understand better the different aspects and nuances of design and how design helps us manage complexity. Now, what I find interesting is also that complexity is almost like a double-edged sword. So something complex can feel like an obstacle to overcome, or something complex can be complex because it can help us achieve a lot. You've talked about beautiful complexity versus malignant complexity. So tell me a bit, why is it important to manage complexity? What problems or opportunities are we pursuing as we try to get a better handle on complexity, including through design?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think power and complexity are almost interchangeable. If you built this series of lenses and gave it to me, I would be able to see much further. And it's called a telescope. You know, and if I built a series of lenses slightly differently, it would let me see the microscopic world. You know, if you look at Hooke and the early development of micrographia, you know, these beautiful sketches, because suddenly they have access to this new technology that extended our reach. So I almost feel like complexity can extend our reach. It can be like a prosthetic for us to extend our reach. But complexity can also be overwhelming. If you think of it, if you were to graph like power and complexity on one axis and ease of use on the other axis, like on the vertical axis, easy to use, up at the top of easy to use is like a hammer. What can you do with a hammer? Like put a nail in, take a nail out. Pretty extreme. You don't need an instruction manual. Okay, great. But super not complex. It's like we can make it with a bone. We can make it with a piece of wood, et cetera. All the way to the other side of complexity, but super low on understanding and ease of use, but power is get to another planet. Like in the 60s, we got to the moon. We got to like another celestial body. I don't think you could make an instructional manual for that. And I think for a while there, we kind of lost our instruction manual for how to get to the moon in some ways because of people dying off over time at NASA and things and erasing tapes because we didn't have computational storage, back then. So somewhere in there, though, if we can get up to the upper right corner, we can actually have it super easy to use, but super powerful. What would that look like? Well, think about like vision. We don't have an instruction manual for how our eyes work. When somebody with a striped shirt enters our field of view, if Microsoft designed it, I suspect it would say, hey, something with stripes has entered your field of view. Would you like to accept? And there'd be like a whole instruction manual for vision. But it turns out it's this natural extension. It lets us understand the world. If we put glasses on, it lets us even better. If we use a telescope, even better. But it doesn't need an instruction manual. And I think that's what we always would strive for, is sort of taming complexity to give us the power so that it fits the way humans think and extends our reach.
I think this is it. It's a great way to end our first episode here, Miguel. For me, this is actually the biggest takeaway, that the complexity is a part of life. It always has been. You pointed it out in the case of natural life, a major creator of complexity. It's getting increasingly important as machines come in, but it can be a very powerful instrument to push technology forwards to make life better. But it has to be managed carefully and with a lot of thought and with a lot of focus on the human side of this. So this, to me, really is the biggest takeaway of our first session. James, what do you think?
I think the image that's probably going to stick with me most is the bias as corduroys. That would stuck with me really well, but I really like that chart that you sort of described on complexity. I think I've been thinking in those terms a lot around sort of the recent use and expansion of generative AI and how that's really shaping sort of the, not so much that the tech has changed, but that the relationship between sort of the average person and their accessibility of the tech is really what's changed. That the models have increased linearly, but we've sort of reached this sort of sigmoid level curve of like, oh, now everyone can touch it and sort of trusts it now. And that's a different place that we are than we were even a year ago. So really like that framing. Thank you.
I've enjoyed the conversation. Yeah.
Hey, thanks, everyone. And please, everyone, also stay tuned for our second and third episode of our conversation with Mickey McManus coming up soon. Thank you again.